Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself. From his bicycle shop in Alfred Station, New York, we have with us today a man who wanted to be a bike shop owner from the time he was 11 years old. Along the way, he'll tell you about the odds he overcame to actually become one. So how you doing today, Peter?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good, Martin.
Right. This is Peter Stoll of Bicycle Man in Alfred Station, New York, upstate New York. You've been working on bikes for a long time, Peter. How old were you? I think I said 11 years old is when you wanted to become a bike guy.
I was 11 when I was helping a friend clean out his garage, and they said the first thing we had to do was throw out these two bikes. Well, that never happened, so I dragged them home and fixed them up and sold them. It took me probably 4 or 5 years to decide I actually wanted to run a bike shop. The first thing I discovered was that I actually was running a bike shop, and then later on I decided I wanted to.
So from 11 to, it sounds like, 15, you were kind of dabbling, and were you fixing other
people? I was trying to close out, but people kept bringing in trade-ins.
Kept bringing in what?
Trade-ins.
Trade-ins, okay. And when you say close out,
they buy one bike and trade three, so...
Great.
The basement just filled up.
Uh-huh. This is the basement of your parents' home, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. And then this went on for, I guess, your parents tolerated the fact that you were the neighborhood bike shop, huh?
I had to keep a path between the basement stairs and the washer-dryer. That was the main rule.
Okay. And that was it, huh? That was it.
Pretty narrow.
Okay. And then you went to college when you were, what, 18 or 19, the same college that your dad's a professor at? Tell us about that. Tell us about how they found out about your bike mechanic expertise there.
Oh, I was a student at the college, and I lived in the fourth floor, and people would call my folks' house, and, you know, they'd say they want to bring a bike in to get it fixed, and mom would say, well, you know, he's up at college now, and here's phone number and his room number, and they'd go traipsing up to town, and they'd haul the bike up 4 flights of stairs, and I'd fix it in the dorm room. Well, the head of the dorm got some complaints about bikes going up and down the stairs and how awkward that was, going up 4 flights of stairs. They wanted to, you know, it was just awkward to walk up and down the stairs while they were carrying bikes. So she was trying to think what to do about it. Well, she came to town with her bike in the trunk of her car, and she carried it up 4 flights of stairs to get the wheels put on. So, I had quick release. I put the wheels on. It took a minute and a half, and she tried to pay me. I said, well, you know, I didn't even lift a tool. That's, you don't charge for it if you don't lift a tool. So she worked out this deal. She gave me a room in the ground floor just for the bikes. I lived on the fourth floor and had a bike shop in the ground floor. And I paid the rent in the ground floor room by teaching a class on bike mechanics in the dining hall one night a week, so that was kind of fun.
Wow. Now, this was Alfred College?
Alfred University.
How many students are at that college?
Oh, probably 3,000, maybe 4.
Huh, okay. Okay, so before we get into Willie and the Chickens and all that fun, let's talk about the guy who gave you such a keen understanding of engineering. Tell us about the telescope your dad designed. And they're world famous for something. Can you talk about that?
Well, my dad's a physicist, but he's a natural engineer. He's a pretty amazing guy. He does things like, one time I asked him if propane gas was lighter than air, and he stared at the ceiling for a minute, and out of his head, he derived the atomic weight of propane and compared it to the atomic weight of air and said, it's heavier than air. So that was the kind of guy I grew up with, right?
Okay.
He didn't take things for granted. He liked to figure stuff out. And now he's got a recumbent, he's got a linear now that he has on an exercise stand.
Uh-huh.
In the last 12 years, he's ridden 90,000 miles on exercise bikes.
Oh, my God.
And
wow.
He's got a book, and he can show you page by page every mile.
Wow.
So he's doing pretty good. He's
tell us about his telescopes. Now. Tell us about the telescopes that the university is famous for.
Well, they found a telescope in the attic of a building that had been lost like 25 years ago and dragged it out, and they're about to throw it away when Dad heard about it and grabbed it and brought it home, put it on a tripod in the backyard. It was built soon after the Civil War. And he rebuilt it and fixed it up, and then he built an observatory, bought a new telescope, and there were two telescopes. And as time goes by, I think there's six domes there now. They have the largest telescope, largest privately owned telescope in New York State, and it's the largest undergraduate teaching observatory in the country. Their biggest telescope is a little under a meter, like 33 inches, 32 inches.
Wow.
And, you know, so I tell people, well, he built the telescope. And they say, well, what do you mean he built the telescope? Well, okay, he didn't grind the mirror. He bought the mirror. And he didn't make the bearings. He didn't make the electric motors. But he designed the telescope, and then he bought hundreds of, maybe even 1,000 pounds, less than 1,000, I guess, hundreds of pounds of steel, and chucked it into lathes and turned, made axles and shafts and made the tube, and he built the telescope.
Wow.
Now, he didn't apply the electronics to it. They've got that telescope set up now so that if you have the password, you can go online anywhere in the world and open the dome and point the telescope and take pictures over the Internet.
Is there a website? Is there a website address for that?
Boy, if you go to bicycleman.com, click on local information, you can scroll down and click to the observatory webpage.
Okay.
Yeah, but the internet operated telescope is there's that's for high school classes. There's some high school classes that do that.
Okay, well, let's talk about that just for a moment. The Bicycle Man webpage. What's the web address again?
It's www.bicycleman.com.
www.bicycleman.com. Great. Okay, now throughout your early years, you didn't stray very far from Alfred because you were car-free. How old were you when all that changed?
I was 29 years old. Actually, I called the shop the pedal pusher for years. But one time I was in the grocery store, and I heard someone in the next aisle talking about, you know, oh, Joe, I need to get my bike fixed. And Joe says, oh, yeah, right, take it to the bicycle. Oh, yeah, right, the bicycle man. What does he call that store? And they said, oh, man, what does he call that place? Well, I don't know what he calls it. Yeah, we'll take it to the bicycle man. So that was kind of funny. I changed the name to Bicycle Man after that. It was Pedal Pusher before that.
Okay. And
that was the name when it was in Willie's house, which I suppose we'll get to. Well, Willie and the Chickens later.
Indeed, yeah. But tell us about Car Free. There's a lot of things
so
you didn't do. Okay, yeah.
I didn't have a car because my dad told me when I was 16, he said, well, you can get a permit, and that's great, but if you get a license, our insurance will go up. And you'll have to pay the extra insurance, which is reasonable. That's what we've done with our daughter. She's 18 now, and she's about to get her license. She's going to pay the insurance. So I said, well, you know, also at that point I was pretty irresponsible, and Dad wisely said, you'll pay the insurance, but you won't get to drive much at all. So I said, that sounds like a losing proposition, so I stayed on my old Peugeot instead.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I just never got my license. Well, when it turned out I got to be 29, and I was engaged to a lady that had a car, so I thought I probably ought to get a license. So I went to get, that's my wife, Linda. We're still happily married, just had our 20th anniversary. I decided to go get my permit. Well, I went to the DMV to get my permit, and they said I didn't have enough identification to get a permit, and I should go to the sheriff's office and get a sheriff's ID. So I went to Belmont, the county seat, and walked in, and I'm showing all my ID and whatever to the deputy, and I've got the form here to fill out for a sheriff's ID, and the deputy says that I don't have enough ID to get a sheriff's ID. So I'm thinking, I'm trying to come up with a polite question to ask the deputy about what I'm supposed to do now. Just then the sheriff walked in, Sheriff Ray Meacham walked in, and he waves at me and says, hi, Pete, and the deputy goes, check, in the ID box, and that was how I got my permit. It's a small county.
Uh-huh. How big is Alfred? How big is Alfred itself?
Well, Alfred has probably got 2,000 full-time residents, and then 7,000 students, college students. There are two colleges there.
Great. Okay, so when you did move out of the house, that was, what, 18 or so? Is that when
I graduated high school, probably
okay.
18.
But you got, what, 8 miles away? You got as far as the next town?
Well, I went to Alfred.
When you moved out?
I lived in a dorm. And then when I dropped out of the university, I moved in with a guy named Willie, who I'd met while I was with a friend. We met this guy on the dirt road, and we thought he was a pretty amazing guy. And he was walking from his house to his farm when we met him. carrying pony feet over his shoulder to set.
Okay, let me interrupt for just a second here. Okay. This is going to be the Willie and the Chicken story. The dilapidated house without electricity or running water or any of that stuff that you lived in. Okay, here we go.
So we met Willie, and we borrowed him up to the farm and helped him water the horses, ponies. He had ponies and sheep. Fed and watered the ponies and sheep and took him back down to the house. We got to know him. When I dropped out of college, I asked if he'd mind if I moved into his house and ran in a bike shop, because I still had, you know, dozens of bikes in my basement. So I got a friend with a pickup truck to drag all my bikes over there, and Willie thought that would be just great fun to have somebody in the house. And I moved in, all the bikes in the front porch, because the house was kind of cluttered. Willie had lived there since 1920. This was in 1976. So he'd been there for 56 years, to what a house would look like if a single guy lived in it for 56 years, right? This is what it looked like. And one time I asked Willie when he was going to paint the house, and he said we did that when we moved in. That was done. I looked real close, and by golly, it used to be brown. So he'd never lived in a house that had electricity.
Okay.
And so when I moved in, he didn't have plumbing. He said one day, I was talking to him about it, and he said, well, one year I figured out I didn't think I'd be able to pay the gas bill this coming winter, so he had the gas turned off, and that winter the plumbing froze.
Okay.
And he just never fixed it. That was like 20 years ago.
Wow.
He just never fixed the plumbing.
Okay, when you moved in, tell us about your bed.
Oh, that story. Well, Willie says, sure, come on in and pick a room. You can have any room you want upstairs. So I'm going upstairs and looking around, and some of the rooms are full. I mean, you couldn't take a step in the room. You'd have to climb over stuff to get in the room, because he'd been using them for storage, and he still was. They were just full of stuff. But there's one room that was pretty much empty. There was a chair, and there was, almost nothing in the room. And I said, well, I'll take this room because it's empty. He said, okay. Well, it turned out the reason it was empty was he was raising baby chickens in it. So it was empty, except the floor had about an inch of chicken poop on the floor that had been there for probably 15 years. And he said we were scraping it up, off the floor with putty knives. And Willie said, it's not so bad with adult chickens, but baby chickens, they really paste it down. Okay, Willie. So we got it cleaned up, and the first night I spent there, we cleaned the room out. I was pretty tired, so I grabbed a bed out of one of the other rooms and stood in the corner and flopped into bed. Well, when I flopped into bed, the roof leaked in this house. Willie would go up in the attic with buckets and put it under the leaks when it rained hard. So I flop into the bed, and one of the legs goes through the floor in the corner and until the cross brace of the bed hit the floorboard. And
oh, boy.
So I'm, pull the bed back up out of the hole and slide it out in the middle of the room and go to sleep. I lived there for 2 years.
Wow.
Willie was a great guy. I should have written a book about Willie. I should have got a little battery-powered tape recorder and interviewed Willie just for months and written a book about him. One time I asked Willie, Willie was full of stories, you can tell. He was just full of stories. So I asked him one time, where were you when you first heard that President Kennedy had been shot? I'm sure there's going to be a story here, right? He thought for a minute and said, well, I don't remember where I was when I first heard that Kennedy had been shot. But I was in front of the hardware store on Main Street when I first heard that McKinley had been shot.
Okay.
That was 1901, Uh-huh. Now, Willie, I asked Willie how old he was, and he said he was 86. Well, one day, if someone who lived in the house years before, been a friend of his years before, came back to town and visited Willie and said, Willie, now you've been telling us you were 86 for 3 years. How old are you really? And he motioned, she leaned over, and he whispered something in her ear. Well, I didn't know what it was. So I waited a month or so, and I said, Willie, when's your birthday? And he said, oh, it's May 23rd or whatever date it was. I said, oh, wow, that's neat. And how old are you going to be? And he said he was going to be 86. So it's confirmed that Willie had been 86 for at least 4 years at that point.
At least
so he was born in 1890 or before.
Did you say he'd be fourth? That kind of got a little scrambled there in the connection.
At least 4 years.
Great.
He said he was
okay.
86.
Wow, okay.
So he was born before 1890.
Wow.
The first car he saw was 1904 curved-dash Oldsmobile, brand new. And Willie was car-free. There came a point when he had a driver's license. but he never drove a car. When the cars first arrived, the government issued licenses per car. Every car had a license, and there was a list of people who might be drivers on the car license.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at one point, they decided that what they really should do is the drivers instead. So everyone who had ever had their name on a car license got a license in the mail. Well, when Willie's brother, who had a car, got a car, the license came in the mail, and they wrote down everybody in the house might drive it someday, so Willie's name was on there when he got a license, but he never did drive a car.
That's great.
He used to drive two oxen, though. Every once in a while, years ago, he'd drive two oxen.
Through town?
Well, just the farm, I guess.
That
was what he used. He didn't have a tractor.
Okay.
He plowed with it. And,
you guys also raised chickens in the kitchen. For eggs.
The chickens were in the kitchen, that's true.
Okay,
yep.
Along with homemade
The kitchen was kind of Willie's room. Willie lived in the kitchen and with the chickens.
Okay, and the homing pigeons.
The homing pigeons were out in the backyard. With the rest of the chickens. There were lots of chickens in the backyard.
Okay.
Now, you can guess the neighbors weren't real impressed with Willie. Now, the other thing, you picture this house being like 3 miles from town up on some dirt road, right?
Uh-huh.
This was downtown. This was on a suburban street.
There's houses
cheek to jowl all along there. You know, every 100 or 200 feet. It's a neighborhood that was built in the teens.
Uh-huh.
And his family moved in 1920, and he just never moved out. And as his family died off one by one, it turned into his house. I'm not sure if the building was even in his name, because he didn't like lawyers or policemen. He said, if you never talk to a lawyer or a policeman, you're doing well.
Huh.
That was one of the Willie-isms that we
Okay. Now, your bike shop was not really flourishing. You were still putting along and trying to make a go of it.
Yeah, pretty small.
And then you ended up getting on food stamps to support yourself. Tell us about what they said at the welfare department when you went in for food stamps one day or... How'd that work?
Well, they told us that because Willie lived in the same house, we had to sign up as a family. But, you know, Willie wasn't there with us, and we really lived in separate households. And they said, well, you know, you live in separate households? Yeah, we live in separate households. Well, they said, do you shop separately? And I said, yeah, I ride my bike to town, which was, you know, two blocks, to the grocery store, and Willie would walk to town. So they said, oh, okay, uh-huh. And you cook separately? I said, yeah. You know, each room that we heat, there's a wood stove in the room. We cook in our wood stove. They said, oh, okay. And then with a little smirk like, I got you now, she said, you store your food separately? And I said, yeah, we store our food separately. And she kind of pounced and said, you've got two refrigerators? I said, no, we don't have electricity or plumbing. We're poor. You might have read about us. She just kind of threw her hands up and said, well, I just can't believe that you lived on what you said you made that year. You know, you couldn't do that, and, you know, we just don't believe it. And we're going to inspect that house, and we think you're lying, and we're going to prove it, and you're not going to get food stamps. And I said, well, okay, you know. I rode back over to Andover, and they sent an inspector over. He walked around with a clipboard, and he kind of stared at the ceiling and went, oh, my God. And they never gave us any trouble at all. They immediately signed us up for food stamps. Unfortunately, they also condemned the house.
Oh, no.
Now, they said they wouldn't throw Willie out, but they threw us out.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, so anyway, I'm sitting there, and the lady, you know, she's like, well,
excuse me for a second. Now, when you say us out, you mean throw you out?
There was Kenny and Andy Glansman were living there also.
Okay.
And they started a candle business, and they have a multi-million-dollar candle business that started in that house.
Really?
Yep.
This was...
It's called Northern Lights Candles. I'll bet they've got a webpage. I'm not quite sure where it is. Matter of fact, I'm sure they do. There's a picture of Willie on their webpage.
Huh. Really? It's called...
I'm going to put the history of the shop on our webpage, and I've got a picture of Willie to scan.
It's called the Northern Lights Candles?
Northern Lights Candles. And they do candles that are sculptures, like a wizard... You know, made out of wax, and they do hundreds of different kinds of candles. But they're most common, the most famous problem for the wizard candles.
But if someone wanted to see a picture of Willie, they'd go to their site, huh?
Yeah, if somebody wanted to, they could email me, Peter at bicycleman.com, and I'll find you their webpage.
Great. Okay. Now, let's talk about your folks. What did they think about all this?
Wait a minute. I was still at the food stand.
Oh, okay. Okay. Oh, that's right.
So I was there, and
thank you.
This lady said that she didn't believe that I'd lived on what I said I lived on. Well, the first year I was in Andover, the shop gross sales was $780. But there was no overhead. There was no plumbing. There was no water. There was no. I mean, I carried firewood a mile in a wheelbarrow, cut it with a handsaw, carried it in a wooden wheelbarrow. This was Willie's house. Okay, it was a trip, and I had lots of spare time. Didn't take that many hours a week to do $780 a year in business. So I lived on $5 a week for bread and peanut butter and bananas, and water was free. I hauled that across town in an old swing I had.
Hold it. Wait, that got cut off a little bit. Hold it across town in a what now?
In an old Schwinn.
Okay, all right.
And so back over to Belmont, and they approved us for food stamps, but they said that if I would just throw away all the bicycles and give up on this ridiculous bicycle thing, that, you know, no one should have to live like this. And this was the meeting where they said, you know, the house is condemned, and you have to move. We're throwing you out. They said they would rent me an apartment. If I would find an apartment, they would pay the utility bill, and they would pay for the apartment. That no one should have to live like that. But I'd have to give up the bicycle thing because a self-employed person wasn't eligible for that program. But an unemployed person was. If I would just give up, they would take care of me. And I said, you know, my goal is to be a taxpayer in the richest country in the world. And, you know, no thank you. I'm going to make a bicycle shop out of this. And they rolled their eyes and thought I was crazy.
Huh. Great.
Well, I've succeeded. I pay taxes now.
Okay, so what did your folks think about your life over there with Willie and the chickens?
Dad told his friends that I was in my Walden stage.
Okay.
And that I would be back. It wasn't as picturesque as Walden happened, but
okay.
It was a neat experience.
And that you would be back.
Then my parents decided that after I'd been in Andover for 1 year. Now, when I was in Andover, I didn't buy any wholesale. I was a hobbyist, I suppose, is what the government would call me at that point. So my parents said that I'd gone a whole year without begging them for food, so they would loan me $2,000, and I could try to really make a go at the bike shop. So I took $2,000 and got some catalogs and started buying bike parts. And the second year, I had 6 new bikes for sale, and it was real uptown, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Cleaned out the old living room, moved the bikes in off the porch. One day I was at the shop, and somebody stepped through the porch floor, so I had to close the shop for a while and patch up the porch floor.
Okay, was this the porch floor at Willie's?
Yeah, this is at Willie's.
Okay,
house.
All right, good, I got it. Okay.
Well, then after the second year at Willie's, my parents decided that I really was going to make a go of this, and this is now I'm being evicted. They told me that if I would find a store for rent in Alfred, which is the college town, all these towns are within half a dozen miles of each other, that they would rent the store for me. So I found a store. It was $200 a month. They rented the store. It was a pizza shop. We moved out the pizza stuff and moved in the bicycles and went to work there. And I spent 2 years there. And then I found this 1849 schoolhouse for sale. I bought it for $5,000, had 4 acres of land. And I moved into that. It was a little more like Willie's. There was no plumbing. There was no electricity at first. I lived in the back room of the shop, which is now the repair area, and started the shop. It got a little bigger again, you know? It just kept getting a little bigger.
So is that where...
I actually had debt. I had a $5,000 mortgage at this point.
So is this where you're at right now?
This is the place we're still at. Moved
great,
in
okay.
1979.
An 1849 schoolhouse, huh?
1849. Yeah,
wow.
There's graffiti on the wall from a guy named Earl Cook carved his name in the wall.
Yeah?
Bad boy, Earl. We actually have a customer that says his great uncle Earl would have been a student here about that time. And that's probably Earl.
Okay.
That's probably Uncle Earl.
Okay.
Wait till I tell Grandma.
Okay, so now that you run the Bicycle Man, it's a national, if not international, business. How many bikes do you have on the showroom floor now?
You count ones hanging from the ceiling?
Yeah, we'll do it that way, yeah.
We've got about 70 recumbents and probably 30 diamond frame type bikes.
70 built recumbents?
Yeah.
Ready to roll out the door, huh?
Ready to ride.
Wow.
Without the partially built linears, that's another 100, but some of those are pretty partial at this point.
Wow.
And there's a high wing.
Great. Okay. All right.
The variety.
Excellent.
I mean, we've got 4 different kinds of recumbent tandems and probably a dozen recumbent trikes, and it's just people walk in here and look around and go, where am I?
Okay, tell us about...
The funny thing is, we don't have any local customers with recumbents. I think there's 1 recumbent within 10 miles of us.
Oh, really? That's the closest,
yeah.
Huh? Wow.
No, everybody drives in.
So,
I bought it. My wrist got sore. And I stopped riding my road racing bike in 95 and bought a Rans Rocket, and I adored it. So forget that. I started to get more recumbents, and eventually people realized this was the place to get them, I guess.
So how many different types of brands of recumbents do you have?
About 14.
And can you run them off real quick? Do you know what they are?
It's like a quiz.
Okay.
Okay. Walk out here and start reading names off. We've got Sun and Burley and Cycle Genius and Lightning and Rand and Long Bikes and Bachetta and Linear and Action Top End Hand Powered Recumbent Trikes and Ice and Trice and Whiz Wheels and Cat Trike and Vision Tandem and Challenge and are you counting?
Yeah. Well, I love.
I've got a 1980 Avatar 2000.
Oh, you do? Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Is it
cherry? 0024.
Is it cherry?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's got a lot of miles on it, but it's in good shape.
Huh.
The components aren't original.
Yeah.
And I've got a 1978 Tour Easy, and I've got an E-Box Kids Recumbent. And let's see, what else have we got here? I must have missed a few. It didn't sound like 14 yet.
Oh, yeah, it did.
Mean Speed.
Okay.
Mean Speed, Long Bike Pin. All the recumbents that come to mind. Then there's Fuji Diamond Frame Bikes.
Okay.
I poke my head in the back room. Oh, Haza. Of course, Haza. Haza Tagen and Haza Catweasel.
Wow. Okay.
There's another. I'm sure there's something.
That's way more.
Managers.
Fennec, really? Wow.
Yeah, Fennec once in a while.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Tour Easy. My gosh, there's a Tour Easy over there we carry. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, I've also got an Infinity hanging from the ceiling.
Uh-huh.
Early 80s or mid-80s Infinity.
Yeah. Okay.
The museum pieces are going to get polished up, and we've got an antique diamond frame.
Okay, tell us about your ace mechanic. You've got a real crackerjack working for you now.
Keith is very good. He's been here for 5 years. In the last 5 years, he's won the national championships once and came in second and fourth in the nationals, and he won the state championships probably. Well, he does more than one state championship. He does cyclocross, road, and criterium.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably won 6 or 7 state championships, and he was on the U.S. Masters mountain bike team, went to the World Championships, where he cracked his ribs and came in 14th.
How old is he again?
He's 60 now.
He's 60.
Don't tell him that.
And he's still a hammerhead, huh?
Oh, he's crazy. He'll go do a century in 5 hours.
Wow. And he's quite the mechanic, I understand.
He's quite a good mechanic, yeah.
Yeah, great. All right.
He assembles all different stuff.
Huh. Now,
it's pretty much a two-man shop. In the summertime, we're busy.
Yeah? Huh. You also manufactured linear recumbent and have been eating and breathing that bike for, what, the last 3 years now?
I think this is our fourth year, yeah.
Fourth
so
year,
just
okay.
Just a little over 3.
Great. Now, you've packed a ton of engineering into that bike. It's in many ways, it's a far different machine than the Creakers they used to pump out of Iowa. Got a lot of history to change here. You know, they're ahead of their time as folders. They still had problems. You still make a folding model, but you also make a performance linear. Tell us about that.
Well, I wouldn't really call it a performance bike. It's a sort of a touring bike.
There's such a thing as performance in terms of commuting, performance in terms of touring.
Oh, that's a good point.
You know, so
we take performers to be a very, in America in general, performance means fast. You know, that's how we...
Right,
you know, that's not necessarily what performance means. We just had a guy our 2006 prototype just came back from a 2,000-mile tour. We loaned it to a guy that weighed 250 pounds, and he hauled 50 pounds of camping gear from Maine to Florida. And then we did a stress test on it to see if there were any fatigue cracks, and it passed very well.
Huh.
Now we're just reassembling that bike, and we've got a few drawings to modify a little bit. It goes into production.
Okay, tell us now. This was the Linear 2000 that this guy wrote. Was this the folding model or the?
This is a non-folding 2006 prototype.
Okay, now tell us about how do you stress test those again? You do some kind of a dye test or?
Well, there's several steps we did. First, we drew the new components on a computer and did stress test on the computer. You know, you see all the computer-generated pictures of where the strains and stresses are, and we refined the drawing on the computer. Then we built the bike, and we put it in a static stand in a lab, an engineering lab, and we put 700-pound pressure with a hydraulic press where the seat was going to be. And we measured how much the frame flexed with 700 pounds on the seat. Then on the computer, we said, computer, put 700-pound pressure here. And the computer tells us how much it's going to flex. And we compared how much it actually did flex to how much the computer says it'll flex. And that tells you if the computer model is good or not. It was very good. It was off by 8% or something, which is quite good.
Okay, Peter, I'm going to interrupt. Let me interrupt, Peter, now, before you get too far off here. Now, when you say we, are you working with this on your dad? Have you got him involved?
No, I'm working with senior engineering students at the Alfred University.
Okay, great. All right.
I have a mechanical engineering major.
Okay.
I'm working with Dr. Steve Mays and the senior engineering students. We've done 11 semesters with them so far. Sometimes two and three projects running at once. So in 2 years, we've done 11 semesters of the work.
Great.
On the bike.
Okay. On linear.
On linears, yeah.
So are you going to call it the Alfred Station or Alfred College Linear at some point? Or?
I think we're pretty small for them still.
Okay.
We may be growing faster than they are. But it's going to be a while before we catch them or Bill Gates.
Okay. So what else? What other kinds of things have you done with that bike that are making
it
a different machine?
Well, the next step we did with the prototype, we strapped the laptop computer on the back of the seat and attached strain gauges and accelerometers to the frame. And then we had a big, hefty college student race through potholes and jump off 8-inch curbs. And we record the stresses and flexes and impacts that the bike saw. And then we used that again to correlate back to the computer model and to refine the computer model. Then we took the bike and loaned it to the guy that had 2,000 miles of riding on it and brought it back into the shop, and we did a dye penetrant test, which is you clean the frame all up, strip it to the frame, clean it all up, and smear this oil dye on it, which soaks into any little pores in the metal. And you keep painting the stuff on for an hour, and so it'll soak in and soak in and soak into any tiny little crack or porosity in a weld. And you wait an hour and keep painting it on. At the end of that time, you wipe it off with a clean rag, special kind of rag. You wipe it all off. And then you use an aerosol can and spray a very fine powder on the frame, extremely fine powder on the frame. And if there are any cracks or pores in the welds or anywhere in the frame, the dye has soaked into that. Then you put this powder on, wipe off the excess dye and put the powder on, and the powder, by capillary action, it sucks the dye out of the cracks, and all of a sudden a tiny microscopic crack becomes very visible because it's this white powder has turned red around the crack. We found one crack, and it was a weld defect, and we're changing the weld procedure there, so it'll be easy to not do that again.
Hmm.
And that was good. I was really glad to see that not only did the bike pass the test, but we were able to learn from it and change the design a little bit, too. So
okay.
That's why you do engineering, is so you can change things and make improvements.
Okay, so Peter, in getting to that point, what kinds of changes had you made to the frame that addressed a lot of the creaking noises that the Linear was so known for? What kinds of...
Most of the creaking was coming from the folding joint in the back of the frame. And that was from the chain tension. When you pedaled hard, especially on a hill climb, the chain tension would flex the frame sideways. So we added a horizontal gusset on the top of the frame, which made it about 3 to 4 times as rigid.
Uh-huh.
That eliminated almost all the creaking in the frame, maybe all the creaking in the frame. The seat on the Linear is designed to flex and absorb bumps, and that creaks some. So even on a welded bike, the seat may creak for some riders. Mm-hmm. Some riders it does, some riders it doesn't.
So what kinds of changes have you made to that Iowa bike that that this person who rode to Maine came back with such minimal amounts of damage to the bike? What else is new about the
Learner? We added a gusset to the bottom bracket that makes it 2 to 3 times as rigid, so it climbs hills a little better and it's much more rugged. We added the gusset on the back of the frame that makes it 3 to 4 times as rigid and also serves as a V-brake mount. On up to the 2005 miles, it's a V-brake mount. On the 2006 miles, it's no longer a V-brake mount, but it has a rear disc brake. It's going to come with added disc brake in the back and a V-brake in the front.
You're putting a disc brake on Linear. Wow.
Yep, Linear's going to have a disc in the back.
Wow. And what else is different about that machine?
Well, in Iowa, they bolted on the front derailleur mount, and we're welding it on now, which makes it lighter, and it never goes out of adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
And we've upgraded the componentry 2 or 3 times from what it was in Iowa. We're using hand-built wheels this year.
Who's building them?
They're being built by a wheel builder in this country.
Okay.
Yeah, we're not building them all ourselves. We check them all for true intention. They're coming out very well.
Mm-hmm,
we've got 40 pair of wheels in now. Started on this year.
Okay, and what's the price point the SRP manufacturer suggests the retail going to be on that bike?
It's going to be either $1,899 or $1,999, I'm pretty sure. We haven't got all of our, the back end of the frame, the new rear of the frame hasn't been produced yet, and we're using a subcontractor there, and we'll see what it costs to get that step done, and that'll determine our final price.
Okay.
It's going to have a Shimano Dior XT rear derailleur with Shimano Dura-Ace tire shifters, Avid ball bearing rear brake, a disc brake, and an Avid cantilever or a V brake in the front. And the cranks, we're going to have a $100 option with a 105 triples, otherwise, it'll be probably a Tiagra crank. We're also looking at the Truvated. We might use a Truvated crank. They're pretty nice also.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we've also done little things. We've made, 4 changes to the handlebars to beef up the handlebar. So every little piece we make, we've made some little changes. We just got some new tooling to drill holes more precisely so that the cotter pins will fit in. We call them grenade pins. Grenade pins will fit in a little easier when you're adjusting the seat, mm-hmm. sliding it out well.
Okay. So it sounds like the Alfred College kids are really taking this project on with great enthusiasm.
Yeah, they do it as a senior project. It's a for credit thing. They can't graduate until they pass the class where they're, if they choose to do a bike. Some have some, you know, we've had 5 students so far choose to do a bike project.
Mm-hmm.
And until they complete the project and pass, they can't graduate. So they're really motivated.
Wow. So
they're
really
great to work with.
So combined with them, there's a lot of energy being pumped into these things then, huh? The actual design.
We're having a lot of fun with it.
Yeah?
A lot of fun.
Great.
It was a great design, but it had some deficiencies that were never addressed.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just going back and saying, okay, you know, it's a great design. Let's just tweak it and get everything debugged.
Okay, now you had an incredible one thing. I've got to take my hat off to Steve Hensel and Linear out there in Iowa for was the compact long wheelbase, the mid-range wheelbase with under the seat steering. Is that something that you're going to continue to move forward with, or where is that at?
We're going to make about 10 of those, 10 more of those, because mm-hmm. we have the parts to do about 10 of them. But the reality is that the compact is no less expensive, or not much less expensive, to make than the long wheelbase. And the compact was always sold for less money. I think Steve lost money every time he sold a compact.
Mm-hmm.
We wish we could keep making that bike profitably, but we don't really think we can.
Hmm.
If we were to make the compact, it would probably retail for $1,600 or $1,700.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the market will support that. I don't know. It is a neat bike.
All I can say...
I've been playing with a prototype of that. I put the bottom bracket on top of it and went to dual 20 wheels, and that's a pretty quick little bike. I like it, but I just don't think there's a market for it.
I'll tell you, I'll tell you, Peter, when I went across the United States in 1986 on the long wheelbase under the seat steered recumbent, I was wishing every time I hit a city, especially in the hugest way possible, for a short wheelbase or a medium compact wheelbase under the seat steered bicycle. And Steve Hensel came up with one. I guess he must have read my mind or something like that. But I really feel that was ahead of its time. A beautiful machine. Totally beautiful machine. I think that if you designed it right, that the $1,600 per copy that you'd have to sell it for might be something you could get for it.
Well, maybe we'll look at that. Right now, we're pretty stretched getting the 2006 long wheelbase out,
mm-hmm.
and we've got a short wheelbase prototype hanging in the back room. I've got a couple hundred miles on that, and that's a pretty successful bike in my mind. We've got a couple things to change. We probably will produce that next. We're getting to the point where we may hire a production manager to just shepherd linear and make things move there a little more, and then we could have probably have all three models out.
Okay, now are these?
And then we look at the tandem. You know, are we going to do the tandem again? Well, maybe the tandem again, but that's going to take more engineering.
That's going to take a ton of engineering, a ton.
That bike needed work.
Oh man.
Oh, and for any linear owners out there, the new short wheelbase is not a derivative of the old short wheelbase. We would have to live the old short wheelbase down. I don't know many people that were able to ride that bike comfortably.
You're talking the Sonic.
The Sonic.
Yes.
Was mediocre.
Uh huh.
It's not a derivative of that. It's
okay.
Like that.
Huh. You've got a website for Linear Recumbent. It's linearrecumbents.com. Is that what it is?
Linearrecumbent.com. Singular.
Singular. Great. Okay. How does a dealer get into one of your bikes, Peter?
Our cost of production is high enough we can't afford to sell to dealers. But if a dealer calls us up, suppose a customer walks into a dealer and says, I want to buy a Linear. Well, the dealer can call us, and we'll sell the customer a bike, and we'll send the Linear to the dealer with a $100 check for sending us the customer. And then we tell the customer that we think $100 is a reasonable price to assemble the bike, and the customer pays freight. And by doing it this way, there's no sales tax because it's not purchased locally. It's being, you know, the customer buys it from us in New York, wherever they happen to be. So the $100 assembly fee is offset by the sales tax they save, and it comes out to be about the same price as if the dealer had stocked it in the first place.
Great. Okay,
mostly we sell bikes direct to customers. People come here and try them and buy them. It's a pretty competitive environment for a bicycle to come to sell here. Someone comes here and they may test ride bikes for two or three days. We encourage that. You'll notice on our webpage there are favorite bed and breakfasts and motels with
really
to a multi-day stay, because what the heck, you know,
uh-huh.
As long as you're here. People drive long distances. We recommend if you drive right, you know, you drive down here from New Hampshire, why don't you visit Niagara Falls while you're here? It's not that far away.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, if people come and test ride bikes, and I don't want to be the cheerleader for Linear when someone comes here to test ride bikes. I want them to find the bike that's best for them. If it's a Linear, that's fine. If it's a long bike, they make a very nice long wheelbase below seat bike. Sure, no problem. We've got the Haza Taggen in stock, another long wheelbase below seat bike. Actually, that's a suspension compact below seat steering bike. We've got that in stock also. We stock the Long Bikes Eliminator short wheelbase below seat steering. So we just want to stock all the options so that people can come and try them and see which one they like best. Some people like this and some people like that, and hey, that's fine.
Great. Okay, well, Peter, we've reached that point in our interview where we've got to start wrapping it up. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think everybody should find a bicycle they like. If it's a diamond frame bike, that's great. If they're not comfortable on a diamond frame bike, they should try recumbents. Recumbents are extremely comfortable. And if they can't find a recumbent shop, then they should look for a reputable shop. If they can't find a recumbent shop that they can go to and test ride bikes, which is, of course, the best thing to do, and if you go to a recumbent shop and test ride bikes, then you should honor them by buying from them. It's not fair to go spend a day test riding bikes somewhere and then purchase it online to save $10. But if you can't find a recumbent shop locally or that you know, in a distance you can drive to, then you need to find a reliable shop online or, you know, find them and talk to them on the phone. Someone will give you good advice to buy a good bike.
Great.
If you don't test ride a recumbent before you buy one, then you have a strong possibility of buying someone else's favorite recumbent. Because, you know, you read a review and Ryan Ball thinks that da-da-da-da is a great bike, and, you know, you read different reviews. Well, that's great. Now you know what their favorite bikes are. Maybe not their favorite, but you know what bikes they like. But does that tell you what bike you like? Suppose you went to a website or a magazine, you read about all different kinds of ice cream, and you decide that Praline is your favorite ice cream, but you've never tasted any. How you couldn't tell, could you? Same thing with recumbents. You can't really tell your favorite until you ride them. So if you can ride them, that's best. If not, find someone that can ship you one that'll give you good advice.
Great. I think what I want to add at this point is, over and beyond just buying a bike from Peter Stoll, you also service the sale. I think that you're there and available for support. Is that not correct?
All the good recumbent shops do that.
Great. Okay. And
there are a lot of good recumbent shops, and I think that there are a lot of. I've made friends with people at the Interbike Bike Show, and there's a great bunch of people. You know, when I bought Linear, I told Greg Peek, that owns Long Bike, that I'd bought Linear, and I was going to continue selling Long Bikes. But, you know, I'd bought Linear, and this is what I was doing. And he said, "Wow, that's great. You know, let me give you some hints and some ideas about how you can save money on purchasing." He didn't look at me as a new competitor. He looked at me as a new member of the club. And the recumbent industry has opened their arms and welcomed us. So Gardner Martin gave me some great pointers on how to enter into the recumbent market and what I should do with Linear. He'd ridden a Linear. Actually, I've got a picture of Fast Freddie Martin on a Linear. So anyway, the recumbent market's a bunch of great people. Bike shops in general are a bunch of great people, but I found that to be equally true of the whole recumbent industry.
Okay, well, I think that's pretty much it for today, but I think I want
Good talking with you.
People got to understand that if they buy a bike from Peter Stoll, they're buying a bike from one fun dude. You're a total joy to work with. As always, it's been a total pleasure talking to you today. You always make me laugh, and oftentimes from the belly, Peter. You crack me up. He's a great guy.
Too much fun.
Totally.
Too much fun. I do this because I don't want to have a job.
All right. Well, listen, have a great weekend, Pete. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot, Martin.
All right. Bye-bye. That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenways Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. For more info about the NBG, go to nationalbicyclegreenway.com. To access this podcast in the future and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.